You please open your Bible with me at the book of Joshua, which we are studying on Sunday mornings. It's just possible that some might wonder about the relevance of such an ancient piece of Old Testament history for us in the 1980s. Now, I want to say two things about that by way of introduction. In the Hebrew Bible, the book of Joshua is not classified as history. You may know that the Hebrew Bible has three sections to it: the law, the prophets, and the writings, sometimes abbreviated to the law and the prophets. But the significant thing is that how the Hebrews saw history was in terms of prophecy, because Joshua is categorized in the Hebrew Bible as one of the prophets. He is one of the former prophets. People like Isaiah are the latter prophets. And the point, of course, is that they see the prophet not as a kind of visionary who gazes into the future, but as a divinely appointed interpreter who looks at events through which God leads his people and interprets them for God's people in every generation. So the book of Joshua interprets for us God's acts in history as he deals with his people at different stages in their life and pilgrimage. And since God is unchanging, the book of Joshua has a timeless value and relevance for the dealings of God with his people. That leads me to the other thing, the New Testament comment on the history of Israel in their pilgrimage in 1 Corinthians 10, which we were studying last Wednesday evening. The New Testament comment presses upon us that the various things that happened to God's people during the course of their history happened to them as examples to us. These things happened to them as examples or warnings to us. And the point of the history of God's dealings with his people is that at every stage in their life, with which we can identify so often, at every juncture in their history, God's dealings with them are an example or a pattern from which we are to learn. Thus we encounter situations in our Christian experience, and we are troubled and baffled by them so often. And the way God comes to speak to us about them is to say, have you not read of Joshua? Do you not know about Jericho and Gilgal and Ai and the Jordan? Do you not know how I dealt with my people in these days? And from that, God means us to learn about our own situation. This is the way that God trains and instructs his people. This is how God brings his people through dark and difficult Jordans that you and I may experience. It is by instructing us out of his word from such experiences as these. And you and I neglect these sections of God's word at our peril, and thereby leave a hole in our armor and deprive ourselves of something quite vital for our spiritual life. Well, with that introduction, we turn this morning to Joshua chapters 3 and 4, where we find Joshua and the people of Israel encamped at the river Jordan, looking across the Jordan towards the land of Canaan on the other side. That was, of course, the land that God had promised all down through the ages since Abraham's day to give to his people as their inheritance. It was the land that God had covenanted with them should be theirs. Abraham, you may remember, was called out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees into the land of Canaan, and he walked through it and lived in it for a time, but never possessed it. But God spoke to him in Genesis 15 and said to him, to your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. And then you get the list of the people who lived in the land whom God is dealing with here in Joshua chapter 3 in order to give it to his people. So the land of Canaan was the land of God's covenanted promise and inheritance to his people. And they were now within sight of it. It was a very special stage in Israel's history, obviously. But the time of year was also of great significance. It was March-April time, around this very time of year that we are at just now in our calendar. But at that time, the Jordan River was in flood. You will notice in chapter 3, verse 15, for example, there's a reference to this. When those who bore the ark had come to the Jordan and the feet of the priest bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest. The Jordan was in flood. And so to obey God's commandment that he had given them back in chapter 1, verse 2 of Joshua, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, was not so simple as it might earlier have seemed. One writer says, between the people of Israel and Jericho, the Jordan was a raging torrent in places almost a mile wide. So this was not the River Clyde that we are talking about, difficult to get over at certain points, but not impossible. This was a raging torrent of water that presented an impassable and impossible barrier for the people of God to go forward into the next stage of God's inheritance. Now it was at this point that it became obvious that God was going to display his power in some special way on behalf of his people to take them on. And in chapter 3, verse 5, we read that God commands them through Joshua, sanctify yourselves, or the NIV better, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. And that he was to do. And here they were on the brink of what God was going to perform that generations were to learn from afterwards, including ourselves this morning. But first we need to pause and identify what exactly it is that Joshua saw Jordan symbolizing and what Jordan symbolizes for us. Because there has been a widespread misunderstanding of what the crossing of the Jordan signifies, I wonder if you have perhaps been party to it. That misunderstanding has entered many of our hymns, and we sang one of them this morning. Lovely hymn. You enjoyed singing it, I know, and so did I. But the dear Welshman who wrote it quite misunderstood what he was writing about, because so many of our hymns equate Jordan with death and Canaan with heaven. And that has entered into so much of our Christian language, hasn't it? We sang this morning, for example, when I tread the verge of Jordan, bid my anxious fear subside, death of death and hell's destruction, land me safe on Canaan's side. Well, if you think of it, it's really a very strange idea to think of Canaan as being heaven. It's an odd place to picture as heaven, because the very first thing that they had to do when they arrived in Canaan was fight. And that's not a biblical picture of heaven. Jordan is thought of as death, Canaan as heaven, but that's not a biblical interpretation. It's part of our Christian tradition. It's legend rather than fact. Canaan is a place where the people of God found themselves engaged in warfare. What this really gives us is a picture that is rather different from this and more general and therefore more relevant to us. Jordan is a place which is unfamiliar. That's what Joshua is saying in chapter 3. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, verse 3, being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it, that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Now that was the point of Jordan. It was that it was unfamiliar ground. It is a new chapter in the life of God's people. It is a new step in their obedience to God. It is a new sphere into which they are being led by God. It is a new challenge that they are facing. It is a day of new beginnings, and Jordan stands for this. And the great lesson of Israel's experience is not that God is sufficient for death. Of course he is. But it is the greater lesson that God is gloriously sufficient for every unfamiliar and for every unknown situation of his people. There are stages in our lives to which we all come at some point, and God says to us, now, pause, because you have not passed this way before, and you need to be sure that you are in the position that God's people were called to be brought into here. Consecrate yourselves, for you have not passed this way before. The Lord will do a new thing, a great thing amongst you. It is a place which is unfamiliar. It's also a place which is uninviting because of the sheer difficulties of the immediate situation and the apparent dangers of the longer term prospect. It was an uninviting place that they were brought to as they came to the edge of Jordan. The discouragement and difficulty in the immediate sense was in this impossible task of crossing this barrier of the river Jordan that lay before them. Rather, as God's people had been brought to the Red Sea before, they had been brought out of the land of Egypt and God had redeemed them, and suddenly they were faced with the Red Sea before them, impassable, and the Egyptians coming behind them, who were apparently invincible. And they were in this terrorizing situation. Now, the unknown, the new, is often like that. The unfamiliar is often alarming and frightening. When you are brought into some situation, it comes sometimes with grief. This extraordinary new world into which you are suddenly pitched, and you have never known the reality of this before, although you have heard it from other people. But it is alarming, distressing, and disturbing. This is a Jordan, you see. It comes with change in circumstances of all kinds. It comes with disappointments. It comes with the disruption of our lives and the disturbance of our circumstances, with being brought into a new place or a new sphere or into a new world in all sorts of different ways. But it was not only uninviting because of the present circumstances, but because of the danger that lay before them, apparently. In verses 9 and 10, you see they are introduced to their enemies. Have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage, be not frightened, neither be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. That is what God had said to Joshua. But now he says, hereby you shall know the living God is among you. He will without fail drive out from before you. And then there is a list of their enemies over on the other side of Jordan. So as God brought them through this Jordan, he was bringing them through into battle and toil and every kind of distress. Now the message of this part of Joshua is that God is a God who is absolutely faithful to his promise and absolutely sovereign in his world. And the testimony that was raised up later, as we shall come to in a moment in these stones, was a testimony to a God who never forgot his promise to his people, who from the days of Abraham covenanted with his people and bound himself to them and would not let them go and took them through every Jordan and every barrier and every trial until he had fulfilled all his purpose. And it was a testimony to a God who was absolutely sovereign in his own world and who had no problems about taking even the rivers and the seas as his servants to do his will and act on behalf of his people. And when the children asked their parents, "What do these stones mean to you?" That's what they meant. That there was a living God, that he had bound himself to his people, and that he was sovereign in his world. But the challenge of the new situation is a challenge to a new level of consecration in Joshua 3:5. When Joshua says, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." And what he is really saying to the people is that this new unfamiliar situation, this challenge, what might seem perhaps like a situation that would fill God's people with fear, it is God's instrument not only to produce a new confidence in him, it is God's instrument to produce a new consecration in them. Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. You see what God is saying to Israel, and my dear friends, he's saying it to us. There are not many of us who know nothing of new, unfamiliar worlds. It may be even within our own hearts this morning we have a sense of the unfamiliar and the unknown. And what God is saying is this: the only safe place for the child of God is to be right in the center of the will of God. That's the only safe place. But when you're there, when you have seen this new circumstance as God's opportunity of blessing you with a new kind of consecration of yourself to him, then nothing unfamiliar need be feared. No new world cannot be possessed for God. And that's what the people of Israel had to learn. Now, the rest of the teaching of these chapters concerns two things which I want to touch on, because we're really surveying rather than studying Joshua. It concerns a miracle and a memorial. The miracle was, of course, God's way of taking them through the Jordan into the land that he had promised. The memorial was God's way of making sure that they would never forget what he had done. Now I want to look briefly with you at the two of them. The miracle is, of course, God's damming up of the waters of the Jordan, as chapter 3, verse 16 describes to us. What happened was that somewhere further up, the waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap afar off at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those flowing down towards the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, were wholly cut off, and the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now, the important thing is not the mechanics of how God did this. That is, cleaved a way through the Jordan for his people. What really matters is not whether God did it by a landslide which caused the waters of the Jordan, as the text says, to pile up or stand up, or whether God did it by some purely supernatural intervention without any natural instrument. What really matters is what God was doing. And that's clearly tied up with the Ark of the Covenant, which dominates this story. Did you notice as we were reading chapter 3, how again and again almost every verse is punctuated with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God? Take up the Ark of the Covenant. They took up the Ark of the Covenant, the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant. And it's the phrase that keeps coming, dominating the whole of the chapter. The Ark of the Covenant was a wooden box in which were the tables of the law of God. But the significant thing about the Ark of the Covenant was what it symbolized. And what it symbolized in Israel was God's presence dwelling in the midst of his people, as the God who had covenanted with them,
and the Ark of the Covenant and the tables of God's covenant were joined together with God as the covenant God who dwelt in the midst of his people.
So the major miracle is not the dividing of the waters of the Jordan. The major miracle really is the presence of a covenant-making, covenant-keeping God with this people, Israel. The major miracle is that God was still amongst them. That God was still ready to come to them. What a people they had been if you look back over their history. They had denied the Lord and murmured against him and rebelled against him, wished they were back in Egypt. They had sinned against him, creating other gods and making golden calves. They had been the most rebellious, fractious, hopeless people that God could have found if he had scoured the earth. And the major miracle is that he's here, in the midst of them, persisting and persevering with them and taking them on into his covenant promise. Because, you see, the covenant God, the Ark of the Covenant, spoke above all of the God who covenanted in love with his people. That's what God's love is called in the Bible, covenant love. Steadfast love, the RSV says, but it's covenant love. And that means that it's the kind of love that will never let his people go. Oh, my dear friends, we sing about that sometimes, and it's so easy for these words just to slide off our lips like water off a duck. Oh, love that will not let me go. But there are some times when you specially need to see the major miracle that God in his covenant mercy persists with us. Is that a miracle to you this morning? Do you view that as the major miracle of life? All the clearing of the Jordans are minor miracles. That's the major miracle. And it's true for you just as it was for them. That's the miracle. The ark stood for the presence of God. You see, the point is that when God is present in power on behalf of his people, it really is a very small thing for him to clear a way through the Jordan. That was a trivial matter, really. The great thing is that the living God is there in the midst of his people, and there is nothing too hard for him. Here's the memorial. That's what chapter 4 is all about. God commands Joshua in verses 1 to 3 to take 12 stones out of Jordan and set them up where they were to camp, and the place where they camped was Gilgal. And so Joshua does two things. One of them almost seems to be an extra thing that God didn't ask him to do, but he did it anyway. And that was to put another 12 stones in the river Jordan when it flowed back again over the place where the priests had stood with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord in the midst of the river, and all the people passed over. God would still have testimony there in the Jordan from these 12 stones that he had done this miracle on behalf of his people. But then they took the 12 stones to Gilgal and raised them up on the east border of Jericho in chapter 4, verse 19. Verse 20, those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up in Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall let your children know Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty. Now that memorial was really for three purposes. It was primarily for the glory of God, that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, And God was seeking that out of whatever he did in the lives of his people, he would gain a revenue of glory for himself. That is always why we bear testimony to what God has done for us. That is what our lives are meant to bear testimony to. That all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty. It was secondly for the encouragement of his people. God's mighty acts in the past, you see, are the great encouragement for the present. Again and again you find this is the biblical way of encouraging ourselves in God. We are to look back and recognize how God has wrought in the past, and then recognize that he is the same God today. And this is the point of memorials. This is why God reminds his people of certain historical facts. I am the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. I am the God who brought your fathers up out of the Red Sea, he says. Now what is the point of that? It's not that God is merely reciting history. It is that God is revealing his character and saying to them, can you not learn from what I've done in the past? My dear friends, that's the great reason that we ought to be eager readers of Christian history. That's why we ought to be eager readers of Christian biography. Not to glorify men, but to learn how God deals with men in real situations. See, stones in Gilgal are not the ultimate memorial. The ultimate memorial, of course, are lives that God has so dealt with as to make a memorial for his glory. And that's the point of the children, for they're the third reason for the memorial. The glory of God, the encouragement of his people, the godly training of children. Because twice over, when God commands it and Joshua puts it into being, he says, when your children ask, chapter 4, verse 6, in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall tell them. Now the point of that, you see, is that they were to set up memorials, but not just memorials in stone, not cairns on a hillside, not statues that they would come to. There is something infinitely deeper that this points to. It is the habit of children in the Old Testament. The Passover is another illustration of it. When they sit down by this Passover meal and your children say to you, what mean you by this service? You shall say to them, this is the Lord's Passover. And tell them how the Lord redeemed you. Now what God is envisaging is that children will say, what does this mean to you? Why do you live like this? Why do you live differently? Why is your life like that? Where does this testimonial point to? You shall say to them, the Lord is a great God and did great things for us. That's why our lives are a memorial. But my dear friends, that's the great issue, isn't it? And I speak tenderly and somewhat diffidently. But I say to you this morning, the greatest need in our church and nation is for lives of parents which will call forth questions from children. What makes you like that? And you will tell them, the Lord. Blessed Lord, hear our prayer. Apply your word to our hearts and make it food to our souls this day, that we may gladly embrace and obey it. For Jesus' sake. Amen. We close with part of hymn 428. Hymn 428, singing verses 1, 2, 4, and 5. Omitting verse 3, Lord of creation, to thee be all praise. 428, omitting verse 3.